Hello, everyone. This is Michael Vandervoort, and this is another edition of the Left of Boone show. Actually, I guess, strictly speaking, our first official show of a new season. So season two of Left of Boone. And I'm here with Phil Wilson, my co-host. How are you today, Phil?
Good, Michael. How are you?
I'm good. Looking forward to having a conversation with our guest today. Our guest is Brant Nunspar. And Brant first met him in Florida, I don't know, several years ago when he spoke at a conference that Phil and I attended, and have followed his work with great interest since. And it's I'm looking forward to catching up. So, Brant, welcome to the Left of Boone show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you to both Michael and Philip. Thank you both for having me on. Excited to have this conversation. I didn't know I was kicking off season two, so I got to bring the fire today.
Exactly. We didn't know for sure either. We had another guest scheduled, and unfortunately, she had a family thing come up, so we had to drop that. And so now that automatically put you in, because we were doing two back to back, so that puts you in the driver's seat by default. So welcome to the opening of season two. So Brant, for our listeners, why don't you start out and just do a quick. Do your own quick bio, because you're like a man of all seasons. You do everything. So tell us about some of your background.
I am a semi-retired rock star that toured with my band Big Kettle Drum for nearly 20 years. Famous enough to make a living at it, not famous enough for anybody to know who we are. And I transitioned off the road about 9 years ago. Started to make that transition and to corporate speaking. Originally started to speak on collaboration is where my sort of career in that realm started. Ended up writing a book about values and how to discover your values called Black Sheep Witch. Became a bestseller and translated into a bunch of languages. And that sort of launched me into a different area where now I'm just fortunate enough to go from conference to conference, helping organizations grow their businesses by building bridges between personal and organizational values.
You're the guy that like when Billy Idol comes in and says, "You can't say rock star." Like you're like, "Well, I was a rock star."
Technically, that is correct. Yes, I could say it. Maybe a little tongue in cheek if Billy Idol's in the room. But yes.
I don't know. I was never musically inclined, so I'm jealous that you could even have made a living at it for 20 years. Right? It just seems
That's amazing.
It just seems so cool. Total aside, one of Phil and I's mutual friends, who's an attorney in Cleveland, his daughter, who's 17 years old. Just played as the show opener in Cleveland for Rhett Miller of the old 97s, who had made a promise to her when she was 9 years old that she could open a show for him someday. And so she got to do it at 17. And then he brought her back on stage and performed with her. It was really a cool, it's on Facebook, but it was really a cool moment.
Super. Well, good on him for keeping his promise. That's amazing.
Right, and a bucket list item, I'm sure, you know. Yeah. So, but enough about Rhett Miller. We got our own rock star today. So you mentioned your book, Black Sheep, and that wasn't when we met. That was you're still working on that. So that's happened since we first got to know each other. So tell us about the concept behind Black Sheep, what the values are, kind of what your proposition was of your book, and you know, you talked about how it took you in a new direction. Talk about that a little bit as well.
Yeah. The concept was birthed out of a crisis in my life at that time where I really should have known what my non-negotiable values were, but I didn't. And it led me to some questionable decisions. And so right around that time, I was having a conversation about feeling like a black sheep. And the person that I was speaking to said, "Do you know why farmers value black sheep differently than the rest of the flock?" And I had no idea. And he said, "You know, a black sheep is valued differently because its wool cannot be dyed. So every black sheep is 100% authentically original, and it cannot be made into something that it wasn't meant to be. Is that not who you want to be?" And I was like, actually it is, I guess what I want to be. And that led me down this a path of sort of believing that we have a flock of five black sheep values. And these are those deeply held personal core values that no matter how much someone might want to try to twist or influence you, they simply will not be moved like a black sheep's wool. And so that was sort of the impetus to write the book, which helps people discover what their five black sheep values actually are.
So those are those values. So they, do they differ like per person or tell me a little bit about like how do you sort of discover your black sheep values?
When the book came out, we also created an assessment to go along with it online. It's free for anybody. They can simply go to brantmenswear.com and take the assessment. And what it's going to do is it's going to sort of present you with about 80 different commonly held personal core values. And you've got 2.5 minutes to go through those and select any particular value that resonates with you. So there's no thought involved in the first part. It's simply knee-jerk reaction. You see a word like accountability. Do you like it? Select it. If you don't like it, go to the next word. Once you get through those 80, it sort of March Madnesses you and starts pitting words against each other. So is it this word or that word? Is it this word or that word? And before long, it sort of weeds you down to about 10 or less. And out of those 10, you have to pick the five that you can't live without. That's how we help people to get to their initial flock of five. Now, I will tell you this. Out of those five, one or two of them are undoubtedly true and correct. And two or three of them are completely fabricated bullshit. And so you just have to sift through a little bit to figure out what's real and what's not.
Yeah. Well, a lot of times core values are, they're aspirational, right? It's like, but then when you really boil down to how do I behave in the world, it's like, it's not that, right? But it's still your core. Is, you know, it's not the things that you wish you were. It's like, what are you actually? And a lot of people don't live that way. Right. They beat themselves up for not living up to like the value that they really don't actually value.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you guys believe that our values change as we get older?
I definitely think that values like can change over time, or the things that are most important to you can sort of change through seasons. I think there's probably, just like you said, there's probably, you know, a small handful of things that really don't change or that are like core to who you are that kind of carry throughout your life. What do you think? You're the expert.
Well, Michael, what do you think?
I think they do change, you know, with maturity and experience. I think that certain things change, but I don't know where that bridge is, right? Like, and I think to your point, your analogy of two are really core, the other three are yes.
Yes.
I think other values like family, emphasis on family may change over time, or it may grow. Anyway, so I think they morph, I guess, is my answer.
So I'm going to challenge you both and just tell you basically what our research showed. And what we discovered when we were doing the research for the book is that our core values are formed over the course of our lives. And by the time we are in our early 20s, they are pretty much etched in stone. And outside of a catastrophic event in your life, they rarely, rarely change ever. So most of us feel like our values shift as we get a little wiser and more experienced. But what we discovered is that the values weren't shifting. The values were misidentified in the first place. And so the idea of doing this work, you know, even the assessment, it's a very shallow dive into, you know, the Mariana Trench. It is a very, very deep work that the top two, you know, our values exist in a hierarchy. and it's a hierarchical system of how they work. And so even when we have five non-negotiables, we still have a most important and least important. And that's why we say the ones in positions one and two, you know, they're a 90% plus accuracy. And you can give me 20, 30, 40 different examples over the course of your life as to why they are. But the ones that are in positions three, four, and five have a tendency to move when you first identify them. And that's because a lot of us have been conditioned to care for other people's sheep. Mm-hmm. We have spent a great part of our lives. Maybe you grew up caring for siblings or caring for an elderly grandparent or a parent perhaps. And so it can be difficult to pull apart your sheep from someone else's. And so when you get this opportunity, those values that are in positions three, four, and five take some significant time to prove that these are indeed yours and not someone else's.
Interesting. So how do you do that, and what happens when, as you begin to identify these values in terms of the impact personally, professionally?
That's a great question. The work when we do it, when we're coaching somebody through it, it's a 5-week process to get to what your five are. Over that time, you're doing some tracking of your values, right? Because values that are real are going to show up organically in your life. And so we're looking for that organic proof that they exist. If they don't exist, if you are adamant that this is one of your values and there is no proof over the course of 4 or 5 weeks that they have shown up in your life, we have to do a little deeper dive as to why. Sometimes we are sabotaging ourselves and not allowing them to appear. Other times it might be environmentally based, where we are in a particular area in our lives, or we live in a particular location that is hindering us from engaging that value in some way, shape, or form. But it takes some time to figure out what that actually is. But once you have them, it's the only way that you can live on purpose. Purpose is something that we talk a lot about, and that's because your purpose is a direct application of your non-negotiable values. It is the activation of those values that become your purpose. So when you look at someone's purpose statement, it should literally have their values in the statement itself. So for me, my black sheep, creativity, hope, impact, empathy, family, authenticity. I have six. Can't be a rock star for 20 years without doing everything to excess. So I needed an extra. That's not unusual. But my purpose is to creatively impact others by authentically providing hope. So you can hear and see my values in my purpose statement. And that creates alignment between our what, which is our values, and our why, which is our purpose. And when you have alignment between those two things, how you choose to live them out and honor them, you become incredibly adaptable and have the perseverance to push through because of that alignment. But when they're misaligned, life can be really chaotic. And the only time you experience that feeling of purpose is by luck or accident.
Hmm. So hope is, that's like a big word. And tell me a little bit about ways that, So a word that I kind of align with a lot is inspire, to inspire others. And like, how does hope sort of play out in, you know, your day to day?
Well, your sort of approach to hope is very corporate. I love that, because that's what I come across on a daily basis, especially when people ask me what KPI hope falls under. I can get that. But the truth is, we can break down hope. And look, McKinsey and Deloitte and some of the biggie consulting firms over the last few years have proven that you can actually track hope, and there are actual KPIs behind hope. But to keep it super simple, hope is simply a combination of desire and expectation. That's all that hope is. We treat it like Indiana Jones' crystal skull. It is not. It is simply a combination of desire and expectation. How much do you want something? And what do you think is going to happen if you get it or you don't get it? And so I approach life, especially with that value of hope, by authentically providing hope, I am trying to make sure that I help people figure out how much they desire something. Is it their desire or is it somebody else's? Mm. And then what is the expectation involved with that? What's the expected work that's going to have to go in for you to achieve that? What's the expected result that happens after you achieve that? And what happens if you don't achieve that? And so, you know, that's how I approach hope in particular. And one of the things that we do when we work with people in defining these values is literally after you say, here are my five, you have to write down what you mean by what you say. Because how you would define hope, I promise you, is not verbatim to how I would define hope with all of those values. So it doesn't matter if we're in alignment with what we think hope is. What matters is that I know what I mean by it, and it's my value. And so that's the only way I can sort of confirm that I fed my sheep. And that's how we sort of approach every day. Every day, your job is to feed your values, feed your sheep. If I have six values, all six sheep have to eat every day. You know, you can't come to me and go, I had a great day. I fed five of my six sheep. That's an awful day. That's a horrible day. You would never come to me and go, I had a great day. I fed four of my five kids today. You know, that's the sort of importance, that sense of urgency that we want people to have when it comes to their values. Those values might not get the same attention. They might not get fed the same amount of food, but everybody gets to eat. Some might get table scraps. Some might get a 7-course meal, but everybody gets a chance to eat something.
Yeah. I think a hope too is like a, you know, it's a looking forward, and it's, we like one of the questions we teach around, you know, there's like three questions that we teach that leaders should be like having conversations with their team all the time. One of those is what's next, right? Which is really sort of like the hope question. And you know, like what's next in your life? It could be what's next in terms of like developing for work, but it could be really any component of your life. And it's really important to be talking about that all the time, not just, you know, your annual review or whatever.
Yeah. It's true. That is very true.
So Brent, you know, what your book is about largely is a very individual kind of exploration, finding out what makes each of us tick, right? But I know that your book has been taken and is being used by leadership groups inside companies, the ROTC and other organizations. So how does Black Sheep Values make transition from an individual to the kind of the corporate structure? How do you put it to work there, and how would our listeners benefit from thinking about doing that?
What I always say is, how can you possibly care for your people when you don't know what your people care about? I mean, that's bottom line. Is you can profess that you care about your people, but if you don't know what they actually care about, it is impossible for you to complete that task. So how organizations use Black Sheep is it helps them. Your job as a leader, number one, is to help other people discover what matters most to them. Whether you realize that or not, that is your number one job, because you can't motivate them. You can't inspire them. You can't do anything until you know what they actually care about. And so this helps you discover what their five are. And when you know what matters most to your people, it changes the way you talk. It changes the language you use. It changes your marketing tactics. It changes how you communicate. It changes everything, because you can't treat everybody like everybody cares about the same thing. My thing that I say to my clients all the time, organizationally, is the number one mistake I see organizations make. They, when somebody joins, they give them their handbook. They say, here are our values. We need you to adopt these like your own. That's not how values work. Mm-hmm. It's more like, here's my dog, and I need you to watch my dog for the weekend while I'm gone. Mm-hmm. That's how values work, right? So I'm going to do it. I'm not a dog guy, but I'm still going to do it because I want to, you know, keep the relationship here, and I'm going to try to help. I have that desire. I want to try to please somebody. But the next time you ask me, I'm going to go, I think I'm busy. And the third time, I'm out of town. Right. It's like but that's how we treat values. We treat values like they can be adopted. And even all the way up, we work a lot with the military. You know, the military expects people to adopt these values, and these are the values you're going to live by. But the truth is, we have to build bridges between our values and anybody else's, the organizations, somebody else that you might be working with. You know, we talk about silo culture a lot, and how my clients want to, you know, we want to tear down the silos. And my response always is, that is the worst idea I could possibly hear from you, is that you want to tear down the silos. People don't understand how it works when it comes to what we care about and how people find belonging and meaning and significance. When you tear down silos, you are creating refugees. That's what you're doing. And so you just displaced your entire workforce, who have no idea where they belong, have no idea what they bring to the table now. And you expect them to just follow suit and all of a sudden be excited that it's more collaborative when you just took the roof off their head. You know, this is how people define their belonging. I know where I fit in this organization. I work in this particular area. I work for this department. I am in this particular vertical, whatever that might be. What we say is, don't tear down the silos. You need to build bridges. Some silos might have two or three bridges. Some others might have 50 bridges. Mm-hmm. It just depends on who needs to be communicating with whom. Mm-hmm. And so that's how we approach it. And that's what I really want people to understand, is that if you want to care for your people, you have to know what they care about. And when you do know what they care about, you can better motivate and inspire them. You can get a stronger commitment from them. You can create a sense of belonging, meaning, and purpose. That leads to a sense of significance. And the sense of significance is the only reason people engage in anything. And that's why you need to figure this out.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, that whole idea of building bridges is, you know, sort of like building the bridge between the values of an organization and the individual values of the people in that organization, you know, and being able to kind of explain, this is how what's really important to you relates to what's really important to our customers and our clients and kind of what we do every day.
In shades of your own work, Phil, it's approachability, because there's a two-way street, the bridge where, you know, I mean, there's definite. So Brent, to wrap this part up, because we want to kind of go towards a couple more segments here, and to wrap up here, now you've got another book coming out that you're working on. And so does it build off Black Sheep, or is it new? Tell us about that.
I'm going to say yes and. So, you know, the interesting thing is, we have collected an incredible amount of data from the assessment, from people who have taken it. So we can tell you, you know, what 20 something females think about what they value, and what 60 something binary people feel about something else. It literally has a tremendous amount of data that has revealed the generational differences of what we care about. So what we've done is, you know, the interesting thing that came up, and the impetus to write this new book, came from a conversation I had with a Gen Zer a couple of years ago. And Black Sheep had just come out. They were talking about passion and how, as a, you know, 20 something, they're going to know their passion, but they might not know their values, and they don't have the luxury to think of it that way. And it really ruffled my feathers a lot. And it was this idea that they didn't think that discovering their non-negotiables was that important when you're in your 20s. And after being able to reflect upon it for a few years and having some conversations with people, what I believe she was saying now is that as a Gen Zer, they're getting up every day swinging. The 5-year plan is non-existent, because they are worried about how they're paying rent this month. They're not worried about where they're going to be in 5 years. And so they're living in survival mode. So that's moment to moment. So the new book is all about trying to find a way to create enough momentum in a single moment to catapult you forward so that that five-year plan, you don't have to worry about that. You're going to take advantage of every moment as it presents itself. And so the book is called Moment Momentum, which is the subtitle is Crush the Critic, Capture the Moment, and Catapult You Forward. And that's exactly what the book is going to teach you how to do.
That's cool. That's and that's a great, I mean, that's a great important message for, you know, for really not just, you know, a younger person, right? It's like, you know, anybody thinking that you have like a plan for 5 years from now is just kind of silly. Yes, and
it is.
And then we just came through, you know, a pandemic that like no one, yep, you know, could have possibly predicted. And the world is, you know, you just think about the world 5 years ago, you know, versus now. And yep, that, like, that's impacted everybody across every generation. So, wow. Yeah. Very timely, timely message. And, yep, and then relating back to the whole, you know, values don't really change that much over time. It's like, if you really want to have impact, you know, those moments that matter, you know, you really, you got to tie into what's core to you.
That's exactly right.
You know, not having that figured out, you know, you're just jumping from moment to moment.
That's exactly right. Yeah. You can't capture the moment without creating an emotional connection. Mm-hmm. And an emotional connection happens by a sense of belonging, a sense of meaning, or a sense of purpose. You can't get to any of those without your values. So you're absolutely correct.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. I'm looking forward to reading that.
Yeah.
Me too.
Go ahead.
I need to get it done.
I literally just hit send, night before last on the manuscript of my next book. And yes, like, it's so great to finally be like, that's now somebody else's problem for a while.
That's right. That's right. Let's let the editors grab it and do their thing and not worry about it anymore. Yes.
Yeah. I've never made that leap, and I can't imagine I ever will, to be honest, of writing a book. So let's pivot. Cause I want a couple other areas I wanted to touch on. So
sure.
One of the things that in hearing you speak for the first time several years ago, Brant, was the story of unfortunate ending with your son, mm-hmm, and the you used music to kind of make, you know, talk about how music creates moments. It was, that's not the word you used back then, but how we remember where we were when you heard a song. Mm-hmm. And then you told a very powerful story about your, you know, so I know that you're big, you know, with the musical background, you're big into the power of personal stories, and you use them quite often. Even here, you've been using them about your conversations with people. So how can leaders may not have that same particular set of, you know, skills or gifts or whatever you might want to call your set, how can leaders craft and share impactful stories in their organizations and take advantage of that type of communication?
Well, I believe that it's how we are designed to communicate, and the idea of speaking in stories is what gets people to remember what it is that you're trying to get them to remember. You know, I use music as an example a lot, and it's because it's the universal language, right? And so when you go to see a concert, no matter how great that concert was, when someone says, "Hey, well, you know, I heard that you went to see Billy Joel last night. How was it?" You don't give them a blow-by-blow 2.5 hour, you know, summary of what he, and then he played this and then he did that. No, you're going to pick the one or two things that really stuck out to you in the concert, and you're going to relay that story. And the interesting thing is those stories can live on for decades. You could be having a conversation 30 years down the road and go, "I remember this time I saw Billy Joel, and I remember he came out and he looked at me and he pointed at me and he did, you know," and whatever that was, it was an emotional connection that happened for you in that moment, right? And again, I come back to, how can you do this? The what we're going to be teaching in this new book is only three steps, and it's super simple. The first thing is, you got to crush the critic. You got to stop your inner critic from crushing the moment before it actually happens, right? Because most of us will talk ourselves out of the moment, or talk ourselves for so long in our heads that the moment already passed us by. And so you got to crush the critic first. And after you do that, you can capture the moment. And that's by creating that emotional connection, which is, can I create a sense of belonging? Can I talk about something that we share? Mm-hmm. Can I do a sense of meaning? Which for me and my son, losing my son to cancer and COVID, you know, that there's definite, people can feel that meaning. Everyone has lost someone. Everybody struggled through the pandemic. And so there's that sense of meaning. And then a sense of purpose, that why I do what I do now is about legacy. It's about my son's legacy, his story. It's about what I'm leaving behind, all those sorts of things. That creates emotional connection. So if I crush the critic and I capture the moment, the third step is I have to share it. So who am I going to share this moment with? Because if you want to amplify the moment, if you want it to last much longer than the moment itself, you have to figure out, what are you going to share? Who are you going to share it with? And where are you going to share it? And in today's world, you have so many options. You can share it on social media. You can share it with, you know, just your group at work. You can share it with the executive team. You can share it with your network. There are so many different ways. But if you do this and you do it with deliberate intention, which requires you to figure out your values, then what you're going to find is that you can take advantage of every moment as it presents itself, and even capture moments that have passed us by, and still get the benefit of sharing it, whatever those learns were, with your community.
That's great.
Actually, talking about music and community, during COVID, I spent many an evening watching you. I don't remember if it was Facebook or Zoom, but I spent many an evening watching you play music, you know, to the world as a way to kind of share, you know, some community. That was great.
Michael and I share an affinity for an Oklahoma band called the Flaming Lips.
I don't know if you're familiar with those guys. I am familiar with the Flaming Lips. Amazing. Yes.
But they did, during COVID, they were one of the first bands to start playing again, and they did it inside these bubbles. Yep. And they ended up, they made a movie about, like, the bubbles. And
yep.
But it's, you know, it's a little bit of a testament, you know, to those moments that matter, and to the to the power of sort of creating, you know, those moments, which as a musician, you you were in the business of, you know, creating the moments that people then went out and talked about, you know, afterwards. Like, that's, and you do that as a speaker, and of course, as an author, you hope that you create those moments.
So in the sort of working through the methodology of the new book, I had to test it out myself, right? I want to prove that this works. And so I decided that I was going to use TikTok, because I don't have a huge presence on TikTok. I'm a 53-year-old man that probably shouldn't be on TikTok. But I fall into that black hole of stupid videos that make me laugh and sharing them with my brother. So I decided that I was going to apply this concept, right? So the first thing I had to do was crush that inner critic that tells me that you shouldn't be on TikTok in the first place. And then I decided to use Taylor Swift's launch of her new record. And so I took that, and I was going to use that to create emotional connection. So I was going to show how she was creating a sense of belonging, and meaning and purpose. And I gave those examples of why, and then I shared it strategically online, tagging the right people of who I wanted to share it with, and hashtagging it, again, being very strategic to the groups that I wanted it to pass by their eyes. And, you know, my average viewership on TikTok for a video was maybe that 200 to 400 range, right? It was not a lot. Yeah. But
you ever wish
first
you picked somebody that was like a really popular
star? Yes. I figured that couldn't hurt to take somebody who was on everybody's lips at the moment. But the first video I did had over 400,000 views. And so I'm like, wow, okay, well, let me try this again, because maybe that was a fluke. And so I did another one, same Taylor Swift idea, but a different approach and a different person and a different who I'm sharing it with. And this was about Post Malone. The first one was about somebody else. And that video had over 350,000 views.
Wow. So I'm like, and then you got the cease and desist letter.
And then I got the restraining order, and they were like, why are you? And I keep having to remind myself, she's 35 years old. We still treat Taylor Swift like she's 16. She's 35 years old, people.
That is true.
Okay. I had two kids by the time I was 35 years old. Okay. Yes.
So I wanted to, you talked a couple times, you mentioned that concept of called crushing the critic. And you wrote something a couple of weeks ago that I happened to catch, and I wanted you to share the story because it cracked me up. And this is your crush your critic moment when you encountered an 80s hairband rock star who wasn't impressed with you for a moment or something. So you want to share that story with us?
Yeah. This was during COVID. I was speaking to a men's group out in California virtually. And this was a group of media, entertainment, and tech. Like that's their group. And they asked me to speak. And listen, I used Ecamm. I still use Ecamm. We're using Ecamm today for this. And Ecamm has some pretty powerful tools that you can use to do virtual presentations. And so I have multiple cameras and I can turn myself into a cartoon. And I have all these bells and whistles that are going. And I'm addressing this group of men. I only have like 15 minutes. So I do my talk. And the guy who's hosting it says afterwards, you know, gosh, Brant, how do you go from being a rock star to this? Like, how did you do that? And he asked me all these technical questions. And this is a very tight-knit scheduled group. So all of his questions are running into the next guy who's going to speak. And the next guy who's going to speak is from a legendary 80s hair band who I won't mention his name, but I will say that he got very twisted with me and he just was not going to take it anymore. And when we finally got to the host stopping asking me questions, and he's like, okay, so-and-so, come on up. And he's like, well, what do you think? What's happening? What are you feeling right now? And he's like, well, I'm a real effing rock star, and I just got back from my house in Belize, and I don't have time to do all this fancy crap that you just saw from the guy in front of you, because I'm a real rock star. I mean, he got his feathers ruffled hard, and everybody in the chat was like, wow. I mean, easy. That was a little hard, right? So I was able to capture that moment by trying to create a sense of emotional connection there. So I was like, look, everybody's struggling right now. We're all trying to maintain this communication, even virtually. We all feel like we're isolated. You know, we're all in the same boat. We're just trying to figure out how to move forward. Where do we move forward? I said, my shot is to do this because I don't have any 80s hair metal legends offering to co-write music with me unless you're offering.
Why not have me on in Belize?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I was able to, you know, it's actually the opening story in the new book. And so that's how I'm strategically sharing it. And I've taken that impact and I'm using it to create momentum for the book, for the new talk, for the whole new subject. And that's how we do it. And that's what I said before, is sometimes you can go back and capture a moment that you missed and reframe it and reshare what you wish you would have in the moment with a larger group, a larger platform strategically, and you still end up being able to create momentum from it, even though it happened 4+ years ago.
Yeah. I tell a lot of stories, and the best, most high impact ones are stories like that, right? Where it's like you're vulnerable and everybody relates to that because we all feel that way, right?
And that's right.
But we, a lot of times, like want to hide that from others. And when you embrace it, it's like, oh, I can embrace that part of me too.
Yes, totally.
So here's a random suggestion that you don't want to follow. I would suggest that for your new book, you get AI to do a deep fake dive of the twisted guy and race it forward for you and how much he learned from you in that moment and stuff like that. Probably don't want to do that. Yeah, that would be, you probably it,
that would be some, amazing.
Might even get some views on TikTok. Who knows? Anyway,
I'm going to start the book off with it's just going to say, "What do you want to do with your life?"
Is that a pledge pin? That's funny.
Yeah. Anyway, so, that was great. So heading towards wrap up because we're running a little over time. I don't want to try to stick close to 30 minutes. So, but it's hard to stop talking to somebody when you're having a good time, right? Mm. So looking at just like music, leadership, creativity, all these things, I know you didn't even mention, but I believe you were like a college baseball player. You've had like all kinds of careers, all kinds of things that you've done. You've got this holistic approach as you continue to evolve yourself and help others evolve. So how do people find those influences for themselves? Because I don't think everybody naturally embraces or appreciates their own skills. Does that make sense? Like, how do you, I know your book teaches it values, but how do you embrace these other things? Like, I don't believe I can draw, right? So I never draw because I don't believe it.
If crush I your tried inner critic, draw, Michael.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. So how do you do that, Bryant? How do you crush the inner critic? Because we all have imposter syndrome, right?
Yeah. So I'll give two quick examples of how to crush the critic. The first is you need to be a bad interpreter. So one of my favorite
got that quotes, one down.
Yeah. One of my favorite quotes of all time is what they see in the ears, hear the mind believes. Mm. You know who said that?
No.
It was Houdini. Mm. So this is what we know about how the brain works, is that our brain really desires certainty. It wants to be certain no matter what we're doing. What it doesn't care about is if we're certainly right.
It just
wants to be certain. Mm-hmm. And so if we decide to treat our inner critic as a foreign language, and it needs to be interpreted for us to hear it and understand it. So what I want people to do is I want you to be a bad interpreter. So if that inner critic is saying, you're not good enough, why are you doing this? It's going to blow up in your face. You need to, abandon ship right now. Mm-hmm. You need to hear that and interpret it for yourself as what you want to hear, what you need to hear. You need to go, you know what? Thank God you're captaining this ship because you're the only person who can pull this off right now. So, this is amazing. So you need to treat that inner critic as a foreign language. Interpret it because your brain doesn't care if you're right. It only wants to be certain. And so if you can get your ears to hear something and convince yourself, you're good to go. And so that's one of the ways that we teach you in the book is to how to crush that inner critic is be a bad interpreter. And then the second way is you need... Yeah, go ahead.
But before we switch to the second one, I don't know if you're familiar, because I write about the same thing in my book I talk a little bit about like pattern interrupts, but how do you like shock the system into, going into, there's a thinking fast and slow. I don't know if you're familiar with that whole
Daniel Kahneman
system too, but it's like, how do you system one, like you said, system one, as long as there's an answer, a plausible answer, it's like done. I'm no longer thinking about it. So you have to activate system two to be like, oh wait, like I actually have to think about this. Once you've done that, you're pretty much good. Cause like, then you're actually going to have to start thinking about it. What, like, is this even valid? What, where is it coming from? You can think it through, but 90, maybe even closer to like 100% of the time we're in system one and just don't think.
Autopilot. Yeah. Totally agreed. And that's, that's the interesting thing is, I did some work at Cornell, and the idea, one of the things we learned about with belief, this idea of belief is that belief is not a choice. We treat it like a choice. We think it's a choice, but it's not a choice. Belief is what you can convince yourself of. That's what belief is. And so again, if you are going to at least put what you need in your ears, so tell yourself what it is that you need to hear, then you can start to believe that. And the more that you do it, the more we get into that sort of system one autopilot. This is how, unconscious decisions, how we're just going to be able to roll with it and move. the more that you do it, the better off you're going to be. The challenge comes where there's a huge moment that has got you so stressed, right? You're in the triggered response state. And so sometimes we need to enlist a critic crushing crew, right? You need to have a few friends that you can call and say, talk me off the ledge, help me through here. I need to move this forward. And I have two or three people in my life that know that that's, and we talk about it. This is your role in my life is when you, if I call you and I need you to convince me of something, this is the only thing I need you to do is to just convince me that it's possible. I don't care how you do it, just do it. And so they know that. They know that if I, sense of urgency, if I get a call in the middle of the day from someone, chances are I'm standing off stage getting ready to go on somewhere, and I need them to whisper some words of wisdom in my ear to overcome that inner critic. And so that's the two ways that we suggest. The first, just being fun. Like if you learn to really be a bad interpreter, you can have a lot of fun with your inner critic.
Yeah. Well, Feynman, right, says, the most important thing is to, don't fool yourself. And the problem is you're the easiest one to fool, right?
Yes.
You kind of need to have some systems in your life. And you've just talked about two that are terrific.
That's right.
So, systems to get out of the autopilot mode and trigger actual thinking.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Nice.
We're going to have to write another book together, Philip. That'll be the next book.
You never know. I first met Phil, and I work for him now, but I first met Phil on my own podcast when it wasn't yet mine. So 15 years ago. So you never know how that kind of stuff can develop.
True. You never know.
I love it.
You saw it yesterday. So we're running out of time, as I've said a couple times. So I want to wrap up, and we like to do like a little – some little pop culture thing. I didn't really tee up much, but you mentioned Taylor Swift, right? She's kind of she's kind of popular. So, who else are you? We'll close just with who else are you listening to right now?
I'm a huge David Ramirez fan. Have been for years. He is a singer-songwriter out of Austin, Texas, and makes me want to burn every song I've ever written. he's too good for his own good. I'm telling you, it's not.
Who's that? David Ramirez.
David Ramirez. David Ramirez. Yes, please.
I will check him out.
If you love melancholy,
Nick Waterhouse. Have you ever heard any Nick Waterhouse?
Yeah.
I'm like deep down the rabbit hole with him right now.
Love that.
Yeah.
Another great
two
one.
Two completely new recommendations for me. I just bought tickets. There's a local club here in Tulsa where I live now. There's a club here called Lo-Fi, and they do jazz and blues stuff. And on June 6th, they're having a California sustainable wine tasting coupled up with some guy who does Americana singing, and his name is Don Flemons. And so I've never heard him before, but I'm going to go check him out because I wanted to see I listened to it a little bit on YouTube, and it's a very unique style. So I'm looking forward to seeing it because it's completely different than anything I've done before. So that's my pick, I guess. For right
that's
now,
a moment
so.
You're going to have to share, Michael.
I probably will. TikTok. I get about 4 views on anything I put up. Anyway, but I'm 66, so nobody wants to watch a 66-year-old TikToker. No, thanks for doing this, man. I appreciate you having you on. It's a great conversation. We will be posting the show next week, so I'll send you the link and all that stuff. But to wrap up, just you want to tell folks, I know you mentioned your website, but why don't you share the details again if folks want to reach out to you, where they can find you?
Yeah, please. My website is simply Brant Menswar, BrantMenswar.com. All my socials at Brant Menswar. Follow me on LinkedIn would be my biggest. That's where I post the most and where my newsletter, a free newsletter is there, comes out every week called Burn With Purpose. And it's all about how to be a connected leader. And so we have incredible guests, writers who do articles for us in addition to what I put up myself. And I'd love for you to connect with me. It'd be great.
Awesome.
Thanks so much.
Anything else you want to wrap with?
No, just great conversation. It's great to see you again. It's been a long time and glad to reconnect.
You bet. Thank you guys so much. Really appreciate you.
Thanks. Enjoy the holiday weekend.